ladies and gentlemen, tonight, live from New York, The Ed Sullivan Show. And now, here he is, Ed Sullivan.
He brought a newsman's sense to television. And so, you know, whatever was hot with that season is what he would book. And so when you go back and look at the shows, I mean, you can really feel what 1957 felt like or what 1968 felt like.
American Idol is as close to what he did because whole families sat down to television at 8 o'clock at night on a Sunday. That doesn't happen now, except maybe when American Idol is on.
Television was once upon a time where people switched on to see the greatest talent in the world, and that was what his role was, to present it. Now you would have somebody who says, is Paris Hilton doing something stupid? And we'd all go, oh, no, isn't my life great? But in those days, Ed Sullivan presented People West. People said, wow, one day I'd love to be good at something like that juggler.
If he saw an act on the corner, you know, a monkey act, he'd say to the guy, and what else does that monkey do? Is that monkey, besides taking pennies, does he take quarters from people? And if the guy told him yes, he'd put the monkey act on.
Ladies and gentlemen, Miss Joan Rivers!
One of the strangest things about television, a critic once said, is that Ed Sullivan is on it every week. Middle-aged, stone-faced, and visibly uncomfortable in front of the cameras, Sullivan was not an obvious candidate for the position of TV's first superstar. But every Sunday night at 8 o'clock, for 23 years, millions of Americans switched on to watch his show. Sullivan's time at the top spanned an era of massive social change, from the Cold War to rock and roll and the political upheavals of the 1960s. But throughout those years, anyone who was anyone in show business made that pilgrimage to the CBS Studio 50 in New York City for their Sullivan moment. And luckily, I was one of them. I am Joan Rivers, and you're listening to Ed Sullivan and the Gateway to America. Born in Harlem in the first year of the 20th century, Ed Sullivan was raised in Portchester. He was an enthusiastic athlete, and he later became a sports reporter. And newspapers would take him to the New York City of the Roaring Twenties, where he would tread the Broadway beat, peddling gossip and relishing the power of being in the know. Here's Sullivan's biographer, James McGuire.
It's hard for us to imagine, you know, we're in an age of television and, of course, the Internet. But back then, there was only radio and newspapers. And consequently, those newspaper journalists had enormous power, especially in the world of, entertainment and Broadway. A Broadway columnist really could, you know, sell tickets or kill a Broadway show. Even during the Depression, these guys lived pretty well, hitting five or six speakeasies or nightclubs in a night, you know, watching various cabaret acts. People would still be dragging his suit to come to maybe a breakfast with him after a full night of carousing. File the column sometime around noon, and then that evening the whole thing would begin again, a sort of a blur of nightclubs, cocktails, gossip, showgirls, pretty wild life, actually.
Before television and radio, newspapers were all powerful, and the columnist was king. Sullivan could boast over a million readers every single day. Theater managers, hoping to harness some of this influence, would hire newspaper men like Sullivan to host their reviews. Here's comedian Shecky Green.
They used to have a thing called the Harvest Moon Festival Ball, which was a dance thing in New York and Chicago. And Milton Berle used to MC the thing all the time in theaters. The theaters in New York and the theaters in Chicago. Milton Berle couldn't do it one time, and he said, why don't you get Ed Sullivan? And from that time on, Ed Sullivan became an MC with these Harvest Moon festivals.
And it was a chance meeting at one of those festivals that would change Sullivan's life absolutely forever. In the audience was a whiz kid advertising executive and a CBS radio producer, Marlo Lewis. Sullivan convinced him that a variety format would transfer perfectly to the new medium of television. It was 1947, a breakthrough year, with millions of people having had their first experience with TV, watching baseball's World Series.
Did see Jackie Robinson hit that ball? Jackie,
Marlo Lewis and Ed Sullivan cooked up an idea to pitch to CBS executives, and it would be just the thing to help the network meet the challenge of winning a mass audience. They needed something to compete with NBC's Milton Berle, so CBS decided to go with Sullivan as a host of a Sunday night show they would call a Toast of the Town, James McGuire.
In the debut show, they actually had someone playing Chopin on the piano, and Ed also interviewed a boxing referee. If you can think about, you know, combining boxing and Chopin in the same television show. It really was a completely broad mix of entertainment because, of course, in that time, it was way before the period of the niche program. It was really, if you were going to turn on a television, you needed a mass audience. You needed everyone in the entire house to be able to enjoy it. And so it went from, you know, juggling, dancing, ventriloquists, you name it, he threw it on there.
In the late 1940s, Marvin Silbershire was planning to make a big mark in the theater when he graduated from drama school. But during a production of The Glass Menagerie, Silbershire was approached by a vice president from CBS who suggested that he take up a job in television. He was out of money and he had rent to pay, so Marvin reluctantly accepted the offer.
Television was just above the circus. Theater was like someone who is dedicated to the church. That's how we felt about theater. And television was a kind of somewhere else that we would never want to get involved in, except in extreme circumstances, which I found myself in. So I went to work at CBS in September 1950.
Silbershire's arrival at CBS coincided with the network's first experiments with color pictures. It was during one of these tests that Marvin encountered Ed Sullivan.
He was at the far end of my studio with Arthur Godfrey and Faye Emerson doing a test with the CBS color wheel. There was a wheel on the back of a television set. It was spun with colors, and that was the CBS entry into the color idea. And Ed was there to test with Arthur Godfrey and Faye Emerson. At the other end of the studio was Ivan Sanderson, an animal handler, with a bunch of monkeys. I heard Arthur Godfrey say, "Ed, I think something's happened at the other end of the studio. There seems to be a commotion." Ed said, "What is it? What, Arthur, what's the problem? Something wrong?" "You know, I think the monkey got loose."
"The monkey got loose? The marmoset? Let's go and take a look."
They all came down to the end of the studio, and I had formed a human chain with the stagehands, and the monkey jumped into the piano, and we caught him. And Ed came forward and said, Who caught the monkey? Who caught the monkey?" Johnny Riggins, my chief carpenter, said, "It was him," meaning me. And Ed looked at me and said, "Young fella, you're terrific."
As Sullivan became more popular, Toast of the Town was renamed The Ed Sullivan Show. But the familiar mix of acts remained, from acrobats to performing bears to Broadway stars and, of course, magicians like Carl Ballantyne.
You'd have seen a guy who walks on stage with a big sign that says, "The world's greatest magician." And I proceed to do my act, which is a bunch of magic tricks that do not work. Producing a rabbit out of a hat, for example, you know, never happened. Cutting a piece of rope in half and putting it back together again, never happened. But the sign says, "The world's greatest magician," on it. And of course, I proceed to tell them how this all happens. My mother is a sign painter, and that started the whole thing.
He had gotten a great education in New York and all those years of producing vaudeville, especially in the Depression, where, you know, the ticket was, you know, a dime to get in or 8 cents to get in. But even that dime was very hard won. So the audience wouldn't come back if you weren't putting on a show for them. So, you know, month after month, year after year, he got all this practice and put it on a live show. And he understood what it meant to entertain an audience. In addition to that, you know, he was such a regular guy himself. I mean, he was not an intellectual. So if he liked and understood an act, it was quite possible, or quite probable, really, that the mass audience would. I mean, he was, to a miraculous extent, he was kind of a stand-in for, you know, the mass audience.
Sullivan micromanaged the show, and he paid particular attention to the comics. He used to summon them to his apartment at the Delmonico Hotel for auditions. Shecky Green reckons he may be the reason Sullivan took a close interest in matters comical.
He said to me, Shecky, Chicky, you never could get my name right. Tonight on our show, you've got Chicky, Chikey, Chucky, Chuck, 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 Chicky, Chike, Chuck, you know. And he says to me before the show, he says, you're right, you're going to do 2 minutes. I said, Ed, I can't do 2 minutes. I says, I can't say hello in 2 minutes. He says, oh, I'm going to tell you, if you want to do the show, you're cutting it down from 8 minutes to 2 minutes. So what I did is I took a microphone stand, which I did in the lounge where I worked in Vegas, and I did a piece with every piece of the microphone. I turned the microphone upside down, and I was talking to a miner that was buried under tons and tons of coal, and I said, you weren't hurt, it was soft coal. What's that? The bird died, that's a gas. Just looking for anything to fill in the 2 minutes. As I was walking off the stage, he come running, I said, you're sicker than Lenny Bruce. And he really let me have it, and it's just in front of the audience. And I said, what's the matter with you, Eddie? You just lost me Canada. They had a mine disaster in Nova Scotia, and 78 guys were buried in tons and tons of coal. But this was happening at the time that I was doing the show. From that time on, so he would know what everybody was going to do, he would get him in a room, a small room, and say, all right, now, do your stuff. Well, he had no sense of humor. You know, he didn't know what was funny or was not funny.
To make sure his show retained its magic, Sullivan would juggle with ideas right up to transmission. By 1953, Marvin Silbershear was an associate director on the show, and much to his surprise, a Sullivan confidant.
Every Sunday night, I sat with Ed in the dressing room between 7 p.m. and 8 p.m. while he had dinner and being made up. Around 7:20, he would look up at me in the makeup mirror and say, Marv, what do you think we should open with? And that was a terrifying question. What do I think? We had been rehearsing all Sunday afternoon from 3 p.m., and we had a running order established. But he was always prepared to change running order without notice. I opened my camera book. I said, well, Ed, you have to open the show, Marlene Dietrich.
Marv, Marlene Dietrich. Who the hell's idea was that? Too strong. If we open with Marlene at 8 o'clock, at 8:05, we're dead. What else we have? What else?
We have the Flying Melendez, dinner plate spinners, on and on. And we have, Ed, the West Point Glee Club.
Marv, you're a genius. Let's open with the West Point Glee Club. Terrific. Just terrific.
But some names would never appear on a Sullivan running order. As the entertainment industry felt the chill of the Cold War, Sullivan strongly supported attempts to keep television free from so-called communist sympathizers. Fred McDonald is a professor of history at Northeastern Illinois University of Chicago.
There are calls for the overthrowing or the banning of the Communist Party in the United States, and there are publications which list people who are front organizations or who have ties to the Communist Party purportedly. Counterattack is one of the publications that comes out with this kind of information. Red Channels, published in 1950, is a thick booklet listing all sorts of Hollywood stars and leftist things they had done in the past. Sullivan used to work with a man named Kirkpatrick who came out of Counterattack magazine and the whole right-wing blacklisting movement. And he vetted through Kirkpatrick and his company, the political leanings of future guests who appear on his show. So you'll never get Paul Robeson appearing on The Sullivan Show. You'll never get Hazel Scott on the show. You'll never get other people who later became tainted by their left-wing political positions.
This balancing act of trying to reflect the culture while still censoring those aspects of it which he didn't like would be a constant feature of Sullivan's television career. And it would become increasingly hard to sustain as the years went by.
A number of reporters asked Sullivan, okay, so are you going to book this boy Elvis Presley? And Ed said, goodness, no, he is not fit for the family living room. I mean, I wouldn't think of booking him. There was a few other minor little shows that Elvis went on to and caused skyrocketing ratings. And then Sullivan said, okay, in that case, I'm into this. And he called Elvis's manager, Colonel Tom Parker, and of course, Parker realized that he had Sullivan over a barrel at that point. And he charged Sullivan $50,000 for 3 appearances, which was an enormous amount of money in those days. You know I can be found sitting home all alone. If you can't come around,
At least please tell the phone. Don't be cruel to who heart is true.
In August 1956, Sullivan and Marlo Lewis were injured in a serious car crash. And because he was still recovering in hospital, the task of introducing Presley to the nation fell to actor Charles Laughton. 60 million viewers tuned in to watch. It was the biggest TV audience on record. I don't want no
other love. Ed was actually flooded with mail. A lot of parents were deeply unhappy that this boy had come on, who they referred to as, you know, a juvenile delinquent. One mother threatened, you know, the television station, maybe we should take away their license. And yet, at the same time, it caused this ratings skyrocket that Ed just absolutely loved. So it was kind of this uncontrollable beast. He wanted this new force, and yet he wanted to please his traditional audience. I don't want no other love. Oh, baby, it's still you I'm thinking of. You ain't nothing but a hound dog. You're crying all the time.
Faced a dilemma. He couldn't ignore rock and roll. For all its dangers, it packed too big a punch in the ratings. So he did all he could to sweeten the experience for his core audience. For Presley's next appearance in October, Sullivan referred to him as a decent fine boy who is quietly working hard for a Hungarian relief charity.
He started the show with a church choir, and they're all, you know, decked out in this sort of a religious attire, and so if anyone came to the show thinking that maybe, you know, it was all licentiousness from now on, he was mixing some virtue in with the so-called vice.
This is my dad's 1956 diary. From the minute we left Derry on our coast-to-coast tour from the beginning of October until just the week before Christmas.
Una McCafferty was one of the little Gaelic singers, a child's choir conducted by her father, James, and touring the United States in October 1956.
And this is this, October 20. Had rehearsal with Ed Sullivan, police out to keep back teenagers from Presley. Show at 8 o'clock, mounted police keeping back howling mob. When we went down to rehearse, there were thousands of teenagers. We wondered what this was all about. And it was because they'd heard Elvis Presley was appearing on the show. Some of us were allowed to sit and watch Elvis Presley rehearse, which was so exciting because the first time we saw him, we thought he was the most divine creature that we'd ever seen. And we are this lovely wee choir from Ireland. And when we actually had done the concert, they were still there waiting and they were saying, touch her, she saw Elvis, touch her, she sang with Elvis. Well, you ain't never gonna.
But when rumors reached Marlo Lewis that Elvis was playing up to his raunchy image, he worried about what might happen during Presley's third Sullivan appearance. It was scheduled for early 1957, and to make matters much, much worse, Elvis was not going to be in the studios in New York City, but joining the show from Hollywood where he was making his first movie. Lewis decided to head west and direct the show himself. What followed was one of the most famous moments ever in television history, as Presley's performance of Hound Dog was filmed from the waist up. Well, you ain't never caught a rabbit. You ain't no friend of mine. Marvin Silbershear remembers the hysteria accompanying Elvis's Sullivan appearances.
I had ceased being the AD when Elvis arrived, but Ed had commended me. Marv, any Sunday night, you can make it. Come here backstage. I just wanted to be here. Never mind the other ADs, I just wanted to be here. So this time, when Elvis went on, there was a riot. You couldn't get one more person in there or out of there. Ed turned to me and said, Marv, get me out of here. Get me out of here. I can't move. I knew of a tunnel. George Moses on camera one had told me there's a tunnel under the theater from 53rd to 54th Street. Just be careful, it's very dark. So I took Ed by the hand with the flashlight and went down into the tunnel. Ed saying, Marvin, what's this? I said, please just have faith. And we went up the stairs and came up into the back of a Chinese restaurant. And the cook said, "Oh, Ed Sullivan, he's here. It's about time. You never come to China at all. You see, you know you have the same fear. And we on the corner here." So we had dinner at the China Doll.
I went to Chinatown.
Although Sullivan had been an avid blacklister, he adamantly was anti-racist. There was not one important black artist who did not appear on his show. And it was this attitude that helped Sullivan get a head start on the new music that was bubbling up from the streets of New York City. James McGuire explains.
He lived in New York City, which of course would have been a cultural hotbed, and he would go up to Harlem and go up to the black clubs, and he would see the early rhythm and blues bands, and he would see the excitement of the crowds. And when he saw crowd excitement, he said, "Okay, I see a gold mine." Crowd excitement for him equaled a gold mine. And it was one Sunday night where he booked a showcase of early rhythm and blues bands, and I'm sure it would have been pretty shocking to the American audience in 1955 to see some of these groups. R&B had entered the American living room.
A couple of weeks ago, I went up in Harlem. I'd seen these shots in the newsreels about thousands of people jamming the streets around Frank Shiffman's Apollo Theater, all trying to get in to see Dr. Jive's Roll Rhythm and Rhythm and Roll, Rhythm and Color, Rhythm and Blues.
And as I look around, the lights were going down.
On the bill of the Ed Sullivan Show of November 20th, 1955 were DJ Dr. Jive, Bo Diddley, Laverne Baker, Willis Jackson, and a vocal group, the Five Keys, whose baritone was Bernie West.
It was really exciting because we've never done anything like that before. Ed Sullivan's show is a live performance. Dick Clark's show is a pantomime. He play your record, and you sing along with the record as though you're singing the song yourself. On the Ed Sullivan show, we sung Ling Ting Tong.
Being live was a big plus for the musicians, but it was a headache for Sullivan. In rehearsals, he'd asked Bo Diddley to master that week's number one record rather than perform his latest single.
Ed Sullivan really wanted Bo Diddley to do 16 tons because Tennessee Ernie Ford had a smash hit at that time. And they worked with Bo Diddley furiously. They even had a prop man, writers, block word, arrangers, working with Bo Diddley up until showtime. You know, they even made words and blocks big enough for Bo Diddley to read, planted it on the stage on a board there where he could look down and see the words. And they worked with him for about a couple of hours, I know, 2 or 3 hours or longer. When Bo Diddley came out to do his act, the first thing he did was Bo Diddley. And Ed Sullivan felt double-crossed. He said that the first time he ever been double-crossed.
Told it inside, baby, diamond ring. If that diamond ring don't shine, he gonna take it to a private eye. If that private eye can't see, he better take the ring from me.
He carried things with him, you know, when something bothered him.
Shecky Green.
If a guy had a dog routine and the dog made a poop on the stage, he'd never forget it. If they'd said to him, "You want to bring back, you know, the guy with the dog?" He says, "Is that, I want to ask you something, that the dog that pooped?" You know, they say, "Yeah." He says, "I don't want that dog again. If that man has got a different dog, I'll use his act." Those insignificant things, he carried them with him, you know.
How do you do? How do you do? Well, it's certainly a pleasure to see me in person, ladies and gentlemen. Every critic can't get over how great this show is. I'm only mentioning it in case you think it stinks.
One of Sullivan's most infamous confrontations came when comedian Jackie Mason appeared on the show in October 1964. What complicated matters was that the proceedings were to be interrupted by a live presidential address.
President Johnson, in the middle of the Vietnamese War, was going to come on television to talk to the nation. And I was on, and he wanted to make sure I get off on time before President Johnson starts talking. So he started to make gestures at me to tell me I got 2 minutes, I got 1 minute. So when he started raising fingers at me, he was distracting the whole audience. Instead of watching me or laughing at my jokes, they were watching his fingers because he did it in a very unprofessional way. So I started to kibitz him about the gestures he was making. I was doing a comedy satire on his gestures. I said, "Oh, you got fingers for me? What came here to watch your fingers? I got fingers too. Do I might stick my fingers up at you?" And I purposely made a joke of it to make the people at home aware of the fact that I'm not dying as a comedian. Otherwise, they would think my jokes are dying. Because at home, they didn't see him marching around with the fingers. In the studio audience, they watched him. He had the audience bewildered, wondering, what is this about? So they forgot to laugh at the jokes. So I decided to make fun of it. I didn't have any idea that he would misread it into thinking I did a vulgar, filthy thing. And when he got mad, I didn't know what he was even talking about. That's how preposterous it sounded to me.
But Sullivan was convinced that Mason had insulted him in front of millions of viewers right there on live TV. He canceled Mason's contract for a further 6 appearances. He charged him with, quote, insubordination and gross deviation from the material agreed upon, unquote. Mason lost $45,000 in canceled appearance fees, but suffered a much, much greater loss of his reputation.
That misunderstanding achieved headlines the likes of which you never saw unless a war was declared. It was a phenomenal kind of an incident that all of a sudden threw me off base completely from being a climbing star to a guy with a problem. And that problem lasted 20 years because he had a huge impact. He has a great, fantastic power. And when he said that I was a dirty person, everybody got scared and nervous. And I went to court immediately saying that there was no such intent. He just imagined it. And they threw out his case and they made me the winner. And I was supposed to start suing for millions of dollars. And my manager said to me, why should you sue Ed Sullivan? He's the king of America. Why don't we settle just to go back on the show?
I'm Joan Rivers, and you're listening to Ed Sullivan and the Gateway to America on BBC Radio 2. Sullivan was holding his own as the star of Sunday night TV, but the growing popularity of Westerns was absolutely eating into his ratings. In response, he began to produce specials from around the world, including Moscow and Brussels and Portugal, and he kept his eyes peeled for scoops. One of his biggest came in January 1959, as cameraman Andy Laszlo explains.
I got a call from CBS telling me that Ed Sullivan is going to have a very big journalistic coup interviewing President Trujillo of the Dominican Republic. They asked me to put a crew together and film the interview, which Ed was then going to present on his regular show the following Sunday. We got on the plane under great secrecy. This was going to be such a tremendous achievement that Ed just couldn't allow any of it to get out. So we, instead of checking in at the airport, we were ushered to the VIP lounge, and the airline executives were all there. And once the plane was in the air, Ed Sullivan asked my assistant to change seats with him. He sat down next to me, and he said, I lied to you. Instead of going to the Dominican Republic to film President Trujillo, he told me we were going to Cuba to film Fidel Castro, who by this time had won the revolution substantially, but he was still quite some distance east of Havana, and it was going to be the first interview by any American correspondent or reporter to be aired on its show the following Sunday.
The interview took place in a port 60 miles to the east of Havana, where Castro had been addressing his troops.
When Castro finally became available, after finishing speaking for about 6 hours in this town, he came into the room with an enormous number of what they called the Fidelistas. The Fidelistas were the revolutionaries. They were all rough-looking fellas with beards, all smoking cigars, all with machine guns and rifles and you name it. And at one point, Sullivan turned to Castro and said, now, Fidel, back home, some of the people claim that you are a communist. Are you a communist? And Castro became livid. He jumped off the desk and pulled a large gold crucifix from a chain, a gold chain around his neck, and showed it to Ed and said, I'm a Roman Catholic. How can I be a communist?
This is called Talking John Birch Blues. And there ain't nothing wrong with this song. As the Red Scare continued to dominate American politics, Bob Dylan parodied the paranoia in his song, Talkin' John Birch Blues, which he planned to perform in his first Ed Sullivan appearance in May 1963. But when Sullivan told him to choose another song, Dylan refused, and he left the studios, never to return.
We'd rehearsed that song, you know, so many times. Everybody had heard it. I mean, we just rehearsed it for maybe days, you know, when they run through the show, they just put you on and you run through your number and you're off. And it always got a great response. And Ed Sullivan seemed to really like it. And as I remember, this was Showtime. And just before I was going out to sing it, they came in and there was a big huddle. I could see people talking about something. And I was just getting ready to play, you know. And somebody stepped up and said that I couldn't sing that song. And they wanted me to sing a Clancy Brothers song. And it didn't make any sense for me to sing a Clancy Brothers song on nationwide TV. So I just left.
Look behind the clothes, behind the chair, looking for them reds everywhere. Looked up my chimney hole, even deep down inside my toilet bowl, they got away.
...90% of the show went exactly as planned. 10% was the exciting 10%, and so you would always wonder what's going to happen tonight.
For Sullivan staffers like Jim Russick, it was the very unpredictability of live television that provided the special buzz come showtime.
For example, there was a French-Canadian juggling act, and they only spoke French, and they juggled knives and swords and everything, you know, timed down to the millisecond, and you would say, oh, my goodness, you know, these people could kill each other if you know, if a light shone in their eyes or something and they missed their moment. And Sullivan was unbelievably impressed with the act. And in the dress rehearsal, he called these two fellows over and he said, boy, this is dangerous. How do you do this? And they looked at him with big smiles on their faces. They didn't understand a word of English. And so the fellow that stood behind Ed and prompted him came out and said, look, they don't speak English. Don't call them over when we actually do the show tonight at 8 o'clock. Well, we do the show at 8 o'clock, and they're fantastic. And Ed Sullivan calls them over and says, you know, tell the boys and girls out in America how dangerous this is to do and how they shouldn't try this at home. And they just smile at him, and they say, you know, no English. And he says, well, then tell them in French, as though they understood the question.
People used to tune in just for the mistakes. He said about Jose Feliciano, he says, I want to tell you, Jose Feliciano is not only blind, he's Puerto Rican, too. Dolores Gray is sitting in the audience, and he says, and there she is, Dolores Gray, who's starving now on Broadway. He would say to the Supremes, you three girls, the Supremes, coming out, would you like to see yourself in color? Well, I mean, who would say that? These mistakes were hysterical.
Hey, life, look at me. I can see the real
A new producer, Bob Precht, helped to steer the Sullivan Show into the 60s, making sure that Ed responded to the changes in the culture. But in some matters, Sullivan remained firmly in charge. Here's talent booker Vince Calandra.
He had this thing about not liking agents. He had a small dressing room on the room 21. It was on the second floor. It was about the size of a closet. We did our Ditto machines and stuff there, and he would have a little door in the back. He was the most unpretentious man in the world. And the agents, supposedly the story is that the agents were up there in the office watching the show one night, and his wife and daughter came to the studio to go to dinner with him. Supposedly they went there, and all the agents were sitting there, and no one came up and gave him a seat. So he had them banned to the studio in the back, which was a small desk that a security guard had with a phone, which was turned off. They would just stay down there, and it became known as the Wailing Wall, because literally what would happen is they would wait there after the dress rehearsal for me or Bob Precht to come and tell him Ed wants to see you in a dressing room, which was like the kiss of death, which meant their comic that did 8 minutes was down to six, or they were going to be off the show.
This is a casting sheet dated 1963. This would have been done at the Hackney Studios, which were run by ATV, and the acts that we were recording to be inserted into the Sullivan Show consisted of people like Topo Gigio, the Del Reys, which was a novelty act, Margot Henderson, who did great impressions at the piano, Frank Ifield, Peter O'Toole, the Knieve Football Dogs. That was dogs playing football.
One exception to Sullivan's mistrust of agents was a young man that he'd met on one of his annual talent spotting trips to Europe. The man's name was Peter Pritchard, and he worked for Lou and Leslie Grade. Pritchard so impressed Sullivan that he offered him a job. Little did he know that Pritchard would provide him with his greatest hit.
Ed, Mr. Sullivan, I should say. I never called him Ed in my life. Mr. Sullivan had been informed of the success of the Beatles in Europe. I used to send him as much publicity as I could of all things that were happening in England. He had said to me at one point, I remember, well, they're just that completely unknown in America, but keep your eye on them. And in 63, we had the Royal Variety performance. Well, that was usually produced via the Lou and Leslie Grade, and the boys were on that show, and they were sensational. And what I'd done was, after the show, I stayed up late, got the press clippings, got them all together, took a cab straight down to London Airport. My contact there normally was TWA, and I used to go up to the rooms where the crews would be getting ready. And I'd go in and I'd say to the hostesses, which of you ladies on the trip to New York? Would any one of you like to take a package over to Ed Sullivan? Well, that was a big thing. And so they said, well, we'll take it. So by the afternoon, I think, of the Tuesday, Mr. Sullivan had this material. Now, I knew that Brian Epstein had left that day to fly to New York because he was talking about a concert they were booked to do. I believe it was at Carnegie Hall. So I got hold of Brian in his hotel and I said, Brian, please, don't make any deals or speak to anybody about television until you've met up with Mr. Sullivan. The rest, I think, is history.
What do you think your music does for these people?
Pleases them, I think. There must be people to buy them.
Why does it excite them so much?
We don't know, really. If we knew, we'd form another group and be managers.
When the Beatles touched down at Kennedy Airport in February 1964, hysteria followed them all the way to their debut appearance on The Ed Sullivan Show. Vince Calandra remembers.
That was the most incredible weekend of my life because we were told to leave our cars home and to take the subway or buses or whatever to get to work. I've never seen such pandemonium. I mean, you know, we were under the impression it was just like, you know, another English group. They made a record, and they're going to come to the United States, and then we're never going to hear from them again. And, oh boy, how wrong we were. The limo had to circle the block three or four times, and we had mounted horse, you know, police mounted horses. I went outside, and all I remember when we finally got a wedge to get him into the studio, Cynthia Lennon was actually being carried by four New York cops, literally up in the air. That's how mad it was. And of course, you know, George was back at the hotel because they didn't know that he was even going to make the show. He had the worst case of the flu or his throat. And we were panicking, especially Ed. Ed said, you know, if he's not making it tomorrow, then I'm going to put a wig on and then I'm going to go out there, you know. But the greatest thing was that I was going to go to the theater that night to time an act for Bob Precht because they were going to be on the following week, and I happened to be wearing a dark sport jacket, and they were wearing a dark jacket, so they sent me out there. My 15 minutes of fame was that I I stood in for George Harrison and actually stood there and they ran the music.
I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand.
Now, yesterday and today, our theater's been jammed with newspapermen and hundreds of photographers from all over the nation, and these veterans agree with me that the city never has witnessed the excitement stirred by these youngsters from Liverpool who call themselves the Beatles. Now, tonight, you're going to twice be entertained by them. Right now and again in the second half of our show. Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you. Remember, I'll always be true.
The Beatles' appearance attracted a record-breaking 73 million viewers to the Ed Sullivan Show, and it became a landmark moment for an entire generation. Here's writer and broadcaster Dave Marsh.
Here's the deal on TV at that time. TV has made itself, doesn't have to be, but it has basically made itself, give or take American Bandstand and a couple of other things, into the enemy of rock and roll. When I was a kid, I looked at the Ed Sullivan Show of like, what awful crap are they going to make us slog through in order to get to what I care about? Because everything that I thought rock and roll was against was on that show. You know, the bad comedians, the jugglers, the ludicrous Broadway singers, the Animal X. It was like a hallucination that the Beatles were on there. That really was earth-shattering. There's no denying that. That really marked the moment when everything sort of changed. Because, you know, with Elvis, who knew what side he was on? But with the Beatles, you kind of knew right from the start, this is different. These guys are kind of on our side. It was also this inherent American hostility of adult Americans to what these guys were, what they represented, what they sounded like, what they looked like, their haircut, their accent, everything was all wrong. It was going to lead to moral corruption.
All my love.
The power of the Sullivan Show had helped the Beatles to conquer the whole of the United States in one fell swoop, and it was the opening shot of what became known as the British Invasion. One spot on the Ed Sullivan Show could achieve more than months of touring ever could, and from that moment on, it became an essential stepping stone for any British group hoping to break America, like Peter Noone and Hermits Hermits.
Our agents in New York and our managers were talking about this guy, Ed Sullivan, and of course we were from the north of England. We'd never heard of Ed Sullivan. And I remember I was pretty cheeky in those days, and I said, well, who is he? And they said, oh, he's very, very, very important. He's like more important than anybody that you've ever done. And I said, well, like, who's been on the show? And they said, well, like Elvis and the Beatles. I said, well, they've been on everything. I said, who's going to be on the show the week we're on it? And he said, oh, the Four Seasons. So I said, oh, we want to meet the Four Seasons. Let's do it. And we got there and the Four Seasons were having this fabulous, like almost a fist fight about which jacket they were going to wear on the show. And I remember that Frankie Valli won and they went on in these pink jackets. And we were very impressed. And Ed was just this wonderful. It was the first time I'd ever seen anybody who didn't make much of himself. You know, he didn't have 10 minutes of himself. And then, oh, and by the way, I've got somebody who I'd like to introduce you to. And I thought that was great. You used to have to do a shtick with every single person that you met on television. And to be honest, most of them were pretty rubbish.
I'm Henry the Eighth, I am. Henry the Eighth, I am, I am. I got married to the widow next door. She's been married seven times before. And everyone was an Henry.
Henry.
She wouldn't have a Willie or a Sam.
No, Sam.
I'm her eighth old man. Second verse, same as the first.
It's impossible to imagine or to explain how big it was. We did the Ed Sullivan Show once, and I think we just put out I'm Henry VIII, so it must have been in 1965. All the bands and all the English musicians stayed at the same hotel. And we went back to the hotel, and I remember we were standing on the roof, and we were with a couple of the Stones, like, you know, Keith and Charlie, you know, the fun ones. and Mick and Tom Jones. And there were like 5,000 girls in the street singing I'm Henry VIII, I Am, second verse, same as the first. I mean, it's quite astonishing how powerful something like a TV show. So these girls must have seen the TV show and all heard somehow on some sort of network that we were staying at the City Squire, it was called. They went over to the City Squire, and there was Herman's Hermits, the Stones, and Tom Jones, who were all pretty big acts at the time, standing on a roof, like, waving at them.
Everyone was an Henry. She wouldn't have a Willie or a Sam.
No, Sam.
I'm her eighth old man, I'm Henry. Henry the eighth I am.
When the Rolling Stones appeared on The Sullivan Show in 1967 to perform their latest hit, Let's Spend the Night Together, I was on the same bill. I remember Ed telling them, you better clean yourselves up, boys, and he made them wash their hair, and they had to clean up their song.
The room that we created the cue cards in was the anteroom to Ed Sullivan's dressing room. So we could observe an awful lot of what was going on, not really being part of it. Our job was to, you know, update scripts or to you know, change a cue card. If an act got cut, we had to redo the cards and put the cuts into the cards. But we could observe all of the hullabaloo around controversies that erupted. And then that specific thing, I believe, started with the CBS censor.
They were told by the CBS census guy that they shouldn't do that. Of course, the CBS census guy would use the excuse that he wants a witness, someone from the Ed Sullivan Show, to go up there and tell him that they can't do that lyric. Being a PA then, I wasn't like that important. So of course I was elected. So I go up there and I go to Mr. Jagger and I said, excuse me, you know, we really do not want you to do that lyric. And he said a four-letter word, mate, and get out of here.
May have talked tough, but both Jagger and Sullivan recognized each other's power, and a compromise was finally reached. The Stones and Ed spent some time together that night. But the Doors wouldn't be so helpful when they appeared on the show later that same year. Despite assurances beforehand, they refused to change the lyrics to Light My Fire come showtime. To Ed Sullivan's fury and disgust, they still couldn't get much higher.
You know that it would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar if I was to say to you, girl, we couldn't get much higher. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire.
They had no intention of changing that lyric. In fact, they were one of the few groups that insisted on their audio guy to be in a booth. So we didn't know what was happening, but I remember they did the lyric and Bob Preck went into the dressing room and said to him, you know, guys, he said, Sullivan really liked you guys a lot. He said, you know, we were prepared to give you six extra shots, but you know, we don't care if we never see you again on the Ed Sullivan Show. You kind of blew it. And Morrison said, don't chuck and jive us, like, you know, we already did the Ed Sullivan Show. And they all, like, kind of high-fived each other, and that was it.
His whole theme had been, you know, the big tent, something for everyone. But as the rock bands really pushed his ratings higher and higher, he really wanted to lean heavily on the rock bands. The problem was the older folks just couldn't handle it anymore. They hadn't minded it early on. But then when the bands got a little edgier and the hair was a little longer and the behavior was a little wilder, you couldn't just suddenly put a juggler on and make it all okay anymore.
Ed Sullivan was a jingoistic patriot.
Sullivan staffer Jim Russick.
His show began 4 years after World War II, in a period where everybody was pulling together in a post-war economy. The flag was an important symbol. He was entertaining a country where everybody had lost a family member of one sort or another, and his own political feelings were, you know, very much in support of the Vietnam War.
There was always a general or two sitting in the audience that he would introduce. But at the same time, people who were fueling the counterculture were getting an enormous exposure because of Ed Sullivan.
As the 60s came to a close, Ed Sullivan found himself hosting a show he could no longer fully relate to, and he became increasingly disconnected. Susan Abramson was secretary to Sullivan producer Bob Precht.
He was just a very lovely man who referred to all the girls on the show as honey or sweetie because he couldn't quite get everybody's name correctly. His dressing room was upstairs in the theater, outside what was the production office, you know, where everybody went to do their work. And of course, we didn't have computers then. So everything had to be cut and pasted if there were changes done on a ditto machine. And he used to kind of wander out of his dressing room. This was especially on Sundays. And he'd be in his shirt and tie and then his boxer shorts. We just thought nothing of it. He'd have his makeup done in his dressing room and he'd come out and chat with us and then go back and get dressed, and we would be ready to start at 8.
Ed Sullivan had been in this terrible car accident and never really was the same afterwards. And he was experiencing some form of dementia, I guess, that people, we'd call it that today, but he's just a little slow on the pickup. And there was one night at 7:05, he came down fully dressed in makeup, with a little napkin around his collar so his makeup wouldn't mess him up. And he says, "Where is everybody?" And I'm looking at the clock. It's 5:05, not 5:08. I'm starting to panic myself. I'm saying, "My God, he thinks it's 7:55. What am I supposed to do now?" He was quite excited and really upset that nobody was showing up for work.
After 1,087 episodes, The Ed Sullivan Show aired for the final time on March 28, 1971. Vince Calandra.
I was there when the show was canceled. I'll never forget it. I was sitting in an editing bay. It was Bob Precht, Tony Jordan, who was our business kind of production guy, Bob Spitzer, who was our budget guy, and Bob. When we were looking at some tape that was shot, and Bob got a call. And he said, "It's Bob Wood from CBS," and I could see Bob like turning white. He goes, "Oh." Bob had a feeling it was going to happen. He tried to warn Ed, and Ed said, no, yeah, I'm that franchise, blah, 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 blah. They already had canceled Jackie Gleason, CBS, and Red Skelton, and Bob got the call. And he said, "I got to call Ed." He said, "Guys, it's over." So he called Ed, and Ed's comment was, "Well, I'll be a son of a bitch." He says, "I gave these guys 23 years. You think, God damn it, they would let me go to 25. He said, "The show's gone. Show's done. Cancel the show for Sunday, do a reruns. I'm not going to that studio anymore." And that was it. We never did a farewell. We never did a tribute, nothing.
We, of course, knew it was coming, and you can prepare yourself as best you can. But when the clock strikes 9 on that Sunday night, you can't believe that that show as we knew it was over. I honestly don't remember the very moment it was 9 o'clock in that 1971 Sunday. But knowing how I react to those kind of very singular events, I'm sure I cried my eyes out.
Ed Sullivan died in October 1974 at the age of 73. Throughout his life, he had rubbed shoulders with the most famous people on the planet. He was just an ordinary guy in an extraordinary world. He'll forever be associated with some of television's biggest moments. So, in this age of multi-channel and 24-hour television, where is Sullivan's legacy to be found?
He doesn't really have much legacy in American television because it's not the same medium it was when he was in it. He had what is known as the variety show. There are no variety shows on American television. There are, you know, crime dramas for the most part, and there are audience participation type shows, and there are what they call now reality shows. You find also no legacy with his kind of prudish, Calvinistic morality. Television now is filled with vulgarity, with jokes that are distasteful to many people, things that would make Sullivan blanch. If he was upset with, let's spend the night together, imagine what he would feel if one of his sponsors was Viagra.
I don't think the Sullivan Show would work nowadays. I mean, we were just too square. I mean, he appealed to the truck driver. You know, he appealed to the taxi cab drivers. If someone, you know, I've been with him where someone said, boy, that show stunk Sunday. He would take it personally. He would be in a bad mood for the rest of the day.
We don't have those kind of personalities anymore. They got personalities like this guy with the American Idol, the guy from England that says, oh, I don't like the way you're singing, you know, you're trying to stretch your voice too much and I don't like it. You know, but that's ridiculous. With Sullivan, there was no matter what mistakes he made, everything, there was a warm feeling. Here's this man that shouldn't be on television every Sunday coming into your home, and it was magnificent. It was wonderful.
Ed Sullivan, you did what you did. If he couldn't deal with it, like Dylan singing, talking John Birch Society Blues, he sent you away. He didn't spend all the time that Simon Cowell spent humiliating you over the fact that you don't agree about what's good. Basically, their premise is, this is all the options you have. This is what music is, and this contest will decide what's good and bad. That's a horrible thing.
I'm Joan Rivers. Ed Sullivan and The Gateway to America was produced by Owen McFadden.
The nominees have been announced, and on July the 21st, some of the finest musicians gather for the BBC Jazz Awards 2008. And you could join them as we celebrate the best in UK jazz. Nominees this year include Guy Barker, Tommy Smith, Norma Winston, and the late Humphrey Lyttelton. To register for free tickets, call 03 700 100 200. The BBC Jazz Awards 2008 with me, Paul Gambaccini, on Monday, July the 21st in London. For more information, go to bbc.co.uk/radio2.
88 to 91.
Radio 2.
Put the needle on the record when the drum beats go like this.
Hello, I'm Zoe Ball, and welcome to part two of the greatest dance records ever made. From a short list of 20 drawn up by a panel of dance music experts, the Radio 2 audience has voted on their top 10. Last week, we heard the story behind the Charades' Key to My Happiness at number 10. Theme from S Express at 9. Big Fun by Inner City at 8. And at number 7 was Fingers Inc. At number 6, it's a track from a British act that hit number 5 in the UK in 1989. It's Soul to Soul's Keep On Moving.
Keep on moving. Don't stop like the hands of time. Quick, grab, find your own way to stay. The time will come one day. Why do people choose to live their lives this way?
I'm Jazzy B of Soul to Soul, the original Funky Dread. We were heavily involved in fashion. So I had this whole thing between learning more about fashion, being around Nelly and those guys, Ray Petrie, all of that lot, Buffalo, the whole thing. We were in and out of the studio. And that time, people like Jamie Morgan, they were called Crunch Brothers and that. Tim Simonon was doing Bomb the Bass. We were